out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday, the 26th of February, 2018. It's the start of another week of the Daily Nationalist with myself, Sven Longshanks, and various co-hosts during the week. And my first co-host for today is we see the return of Simon Shepherd, who was in court last week, you may remember. We talked a little bit about the case, the charges that were against him, and encouraged people to go. And we were a little bit worried that he might not actually still be at home by the time of the weekend. And thankfully he is, and thankfully he's here today. So I guess the first thing to do is say, how are you doing, Simon? And secondly, ask you what happened in court.
Well, thanks, Sven. I'm very grateful for your support. Yes, it was quite an eventful Thursday. I turned up in my suit and fearing the worst. There's about a dozen people came to support me, which cheered me up no end, distracted me, you know, during all the hanging around and everything. In fact, the day before, I'd had a bit of a hint from the lawyer that things weren't going quite as well for the prosecution as they might. But I dared to hope and basically psyched myself up for the worst. Anyway, I turned up and I sat in the dock and waiting around. And I noticed these screens to the side, and I asked the, there's some kind of guard in the dock with you. I asked him what was going on, and he said, they're screens so that you can't see the witness and the witness can't see you. And I'd heard of this before, that he was claiming that he was afraid of violence and all this stuff and playing the vulnerable victim. But the plan apparently was not that he was going to appear by video link or that he was going to be shielded off in the witness box, but the idea was that these screens were going to be placed in front of me so that he wouldn't have to, the traumatic experience of having to look at me, you see. It turned out that he wasn't attending. And then came a string of excuses and more information, which is I could go into if you want. The upshot of it was that it's been put off, and it could still pick up, but apparently the council and the police have been practically hounding him. You know, they're accusing me of racially aggravated harassment, but that seems to be exactly what they're doing to him. You know, in their fervent pursuit of getting Simon Shepherd into a court and to jail, they've been hounding this man to appear and testify against me. Even though, you know, they of course believe every word he says, but I know that it's all fictitious. Anyway, he doesn't want to go. He says he's overwhelmed. He said he was overwhelmed by the prospect of appearing in court, and he feels let down by the police and the council. In fact, the police had been, going around to visit him and leaving him text messages and leaving him voicemails and phoning him and all this stuff. You know, about a dozen occasions. They're all listed by my barrister, and he doesn't appear to want to appear in court at all. And I think it's probably because he's afraid of the shredding that my barrister was going to give him.
I should imagine he really doesn't want to be in court. I bet he's got lots of things that he would rather the court didn't hear about. And I bet he's also got a fear of being in court from being in trouble with the police before. If he's the sort of Negro that's going to lie and play the victim and make out that you're some kind of big racist bully, of course he's not going to want to have to face you after telling all those lies. That's the reason for it, isn't it? He's told all these bald-faced lies. And so now he doesn't want to face you. He thinks that he will just get away with making these accusations. You'll get fined or locked up, and he'll get a free house out of it. That's his game, I reckon.
Well, yeah, I think that's very likely. But you see, what we know and what we don't know, well, he doesn't know what we know and what we don't know. And I know enough to give my barrister plenty of ammunition to discredit him, but I'm quite confident there's a lot more that we don't know about.
Well, we don't want to go. We don't want to go into anything that could prejudice the case at all.
No, I can't really say what I do know, because it's still sub judice. What happened was that in any sane circumstance, it would have just been dropped there and then. If someone's a complainant, but he's not bothered about it enough to turn up in court, and we didn't see them, but there was a jury, there was my 12 or so supporters sitting in the back of the court, and we didn't see them, but there would have been another 12 at least jurors all waiting, all keyed up, ready to go. The Sky TV man who's white, by the way, who made the original complaint and started it all off, he was there keen to testify. But all of this, all for nothing, as far as the prosecution's concerned, and in any sense, circumstance, they'd have just dropped it, because if he's not, if he's obviously not aggrieved enough to appear in court, then why should we bother? But they're also so desperately keen to play what's the psychological term, altruistic punishment, on the foreigner's behalf, and the foreigner's simply not going along with it. It's mad, completely mad.
I think normally, if you don't turn up in court for something like that, and they've got a jury there, they've got everybody there, you think how much it costs to run a court for a day?
Oh, yeah.
They've booked the court for a day and a half. I mean, that guy should have been arrested and held up for contempt of court. And I dare say that's what would normally happen in a situation like that. But because it's racism...
Obviously, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not that experienced about it. But the court has the power to actually summons them. But what I have heard is that, an unwilling witness is generally pretty useless for them.
Well, I hope he is useless for them. So you've got a month, and then you've got to go through all this all over again, and he might not turn up again in a month's time either.
No, what's happened is that the judge, rather than just kick it out outright, the judge has given the police another month to try and secure a commitment from him to testify. And if they do, then there's going to be another trial in mid-June. I wouldn't put it past the council that they'll promise him a house or strongly hint that something that they can deny, if you testify, we'll give you a house, because I think that's actually what he's angling for or been angling for. What he's been doing, basically, he just says anything that he thinks will fly. When he accused me of shouting at him, fuck off, nigger, back to Africa and all this. I'm supposed to have done it several times. Shouted, not just said. And the police, in his statement, in his original statement, which I bet he now regrets making, because, he's actually being hounded by the police to try and get him to court. He said that the police asked him, why didn't you report it, before? Oh, he said, it's because I'm sure it's all based on ignorance. Portraying me as like the media stereotype of being just a knuckle dragging skinhead. You know, and that's just pure, you know, just the media playbook, isn't it?
Yeah.
He just says whatever we'll think will fly. And now he's saying that, you know, he feels let down by the police and the council, whereas they've both been absolutely bending over backwards for him. So, you know, this is the sort of people that, we're dealing with, they just, you know, take every opportunity. You know,
Professional victims, aren't they? You know, they just want to see what they can make.
There's an interesting point here as well. You know, it's like there's a spectrum between animal and human. And you know, civilized society, you know, is a human creation. Well, say if a fox, you know, is going through the wood and comes across a bird with a broken wing. He doesn't think, oh, that poor bird, I'll leave it alone. No, he thinks, you know, I've got a quick snack. He's landed in my lap. And off it goes, and the bird's history, you know, pretty quickly. Whereas humans, the higher civilization, the more human, you know, we see someone that's vulnerable, and we back off. You know, even a white mugger, you know, he's quite prepared to have a fight with someone his own age, his own build. But you know, if you see someone in a wheelchair, say, or old and infirm, you know, or an old lady, you know, think, oh, you know, that's a line I won't cross. You know, they're so vulnerable. I'm not gonna go for them. Whereas, I remember hearing a story, and it's typical because I'm sure I've heard others, of this Dutch friend I had in Amsterdam. And he was walking, there was a car with four Moroccans, I think, in it, just sitting at the side of the road, and he's walking along. And he just stumbled briefly on a paving slab or something. And immediately he showed that vulnerability. They all jumped out of the car and beat him up.
This is a typical black thing. This is a typical black thing. This is it. White people see people that are suffering in some way, and we will try to help. And I would suggest that your white mugger in your instance there, we probably open the door up for the person in the wheelchair. He wouldn't think of mugging them. Whereas blacks, if they see somebody suffering, they see weakness. They see a chance to attack.
It's the animal thing, you know. The laws of nature, the raw nature in the wild, is that the weak perish quickly. You know, because they're immediately signaling their vulnerability, which opportunity will be immediately be made, you know, quickly and without delay. Whereas in the humans, you know, the higher the humans. You know, we see vulnerability and we back off. It's the opposite reaction.
Well, it's an emotional reaction on the part of the blacks, and because it's an emotional reaction, it passes very quickly as well. So he made all these accusations against you, thinking what he was going to get out of it, but now it's a few months later, and the moment has passed, and he doesn't want to have to go to court, and all the other things are involved in it. He doesn't want to do all that, because he just saw an instance, I can get something. Because right. they don't think in terms of what's happening in the future, do they? It's always instant gratification with Negroes.
Yeah, impulse control. Poor impulse control is the phrase that I've seen.
That's the one.
So you know, that's an important point. You know, this difference between also, you know, I found women to be very opportunistic too. You know, I really do think women are less evolved than men.
Well, they are, aren't they? I mean, I've heard you make this point before about the womb, and males are more evolved than females. We do. We evolve more in the womb.
Well, there's a much more complex process goes on in the brain.
We are more highly evolved beings. I know you wanted to talk a little bit about evolutionary psychology today as well, Simon, and what you've been working on for Heritage and Destiny. I'd also just like to recommend Heritage and Destiny to our listeners. Get a subscription to Heritage and Destiny, British nationalist magazine, comes out every 2 months, and Simon is one of the writers there. And I know you wanted to talk a bit about that and a bit about evolutionary psychology. So do you want to go into a bit of that, Simon?
Right. Well, there is a particular aspect that comes out in my latest article. It's just been sent in. The next issue of Heritage and Destiny is going to have an article called Hive Minds, which I think is quite good. The one that's in the queue for next time is called Madness by Media. And I think it's an important point, an important aspect. Almost everything has got an evolutionary explanation. You know, you can trace it back. For example, you know, suppose you're drinking a cup of tea and you go off, you're distracted, you go somewhere else. And then there's a nagging feeling at the back of your brain, oh, there's something outstanding, something missing. And then you remember, oh, yeah, I've got half a cup of tea left. You know, you can see that, you know, that confers a benefit. You know, like you've got unfinished food. And obviously, if you can remember that you've got unfinished food and you eat it, that gives you a survival advantage. Now, but the point is that one of the few things that there is absolutely no, and I'm talking evolutionary psychology in terms of behavior, not in terms of, you know, growing new limbs or something like that. It's a different kind of evolution. That there's no precedent whatever for radio and TV and film. You know, it's only been around, you know, less than 100 years. So in fact, we've got no defense against it. And this is how the Jews who control the media have got so much influence, have been able to wield so much influence, because we're completely defenseless against that massive power. And I draw the comparison between the ear. You know, I know a little bit about ears. In fact, the hearing is less well understood than sight. If we listen to loud music, we can very easily damage the hair cells within the cochlea. You know, the cochlea is this sort of helix-type assembly of bone within the ear, the inner ear. It's also called the inner ear. And lining that is these hairs, tiny hairs, which connect with the cell, which when those hairs vibrate, it sends a signal to the brain. The interesting thing is, there's actually a signal that comes from the brain back to the ear. And this is, at least when I was looking into it, this is very poorly understood. But the point is that excessive loud noise, sustained loud noise, like all these idiots that were wearing these earphones, at, you know, really loud levels, you know, they're just completely destroying the hair cells. And similarly, there's no defense against that, because, you know, up until less than 100 years ago, the only time such sound levels were actually encountered was when a volcano erupted suddenly, or you know, an avalanche or something like that. You know, very, very exceptional.
Clap of thunder, and that sort of thing.
Well, thunder is, you know, maybe 100 dB, you know, but the threshold of pain is about 120 dB, if I remember correctly. That's when it actually starts to hurt. But if you go 100 or above for any length of time, you're going to be killing hair cells. And when you're young, you don't notice it because you've got so much spare capacity in hearing. But what will happen is that, you know, as you get older, as your hearing capacity diminishes, you'll start getting tinnitus and going deaf, basically, you know, because you've already killed 30% of your hair cells. And it comes back on you later in life. A thunderclap, you know, is generally short duration, and, you know, I'd be surprised if it reached 100 dB.
Well, I'll just say there as well. I mean, with the hearing, you mentioned that if it goes above 120 decibels, then you've got pain that steps in to say your hearing is being damaged, even though it's something that happens rarely. Even though it's something that happens rarely, you will still get pain to tell you that your body's being damaged. But where's the pain to tell us that we're being damaged by the media. We haven't even got that.
Exactly. Well, there's no defence. We simply have, you know, try and think of, what was the closest? You know, the closest would be, say, these medieval players that used to travel from village to village and survive on donations by giving these sort of mystery plays and things like that. That's the closest you can come to actual television nowadays. And then everyone knew that there were people, you know, just acting out a play or a myth or something like that on the stage. You know, I'm sure they were captivated by it, and it was a great event, but they didn't have all the sound effects and the special effects and the illusion of reality that there is now. You know, and the voice of authority, you know, like a newsreader sitting behind a desk and, you know, speaking to millions, you know, and people are it's quite reasonable to expect that they're telling the truth. Not that they're bit twisting reality entirely or missing out all sorts of other things that they should be told but aren't. It's, you know, the power. In fact, when cinema first started in America, there were Russian agents kicking around. You know, just not particularly sinister, but there were Russian agents in America, and they reported back to their handlers in Russia. You know, there was this fantastic new technology that could change public opinion in a weekend. You know, it was phenomenal. You know, they could bring out a film and show it to all these people up and down the country, and it changed public attitudes in a weekend. You know, the power of that. And obviously, you know, that this probably accounts for why Stalin was so keen on producing all these propaganda films and things like that, because he realized this is a supremely powerful tool.
I remember learning about these early films, and there was one where they had a train, and people were diving out the way of the train because they believed it was real. So that the body is still thinking that this is real, and then the mind has to cut in to say that it isn't. But as far as the voice of authority, why would we think that the people above us would lie? Why would we think the king would lie to us? And when we had these mummers plays that you were talking about there, so they were very wholesome. I mean, we had mummers plays that were St. George and the Turk, and the Turk would be stealing a white woman as a white slave to rape her, and St. George would be killing the Turk and rescuing the white woman. And that was right. one of our most popular mummers plays. So we wouldn't think of it.
Changing the subject a little bit, basically, you know, to mention what our civilization, how our civilizations come, and the things that our ancestors have endured to give us to put us in the position we are now. I was reading a book recently about pirates, and I discovered something that's quite interesting. That if you refuse to enter a plea, what they would do is tie you to the ground and put weights on you, and until you either said you were either not guilty or guilty, and it could continue to put weights on you so that it would be difficult to breathe, and if you didn't enter a plea within 2 or 3 days, you basically died. And, these are in the days of, where you were thrown into prison in the workhouse, you know, if you couldn't pay your debts. And I've recently turned up another thing as well. It's actually mentioned by Dickens. It's in the preface to Barnaby Rudge of this Mary Jones, the case of Mary Jones. Her husband, this is in 1777. Her husband was stolen from her. That's how she put it. He'd been press ganged. And because she didn't have anyone to support her, she quickly found herself on the street. You know, the possessions were stolen for debts, and or taken away for debts. And she tried to shoplift some coarse cloth in Ludgate Street. Or is it just Ludgate? Yeah, Ludgate. And she was spotted by the shopkeeper, so she immediately put it back. She was 18, and apparently, according to the accounts, very handsome indeed, and two small children, one of whom was still breastfeeding. And anyway, they wanted to, because there'd been a bit of shoplifting going on in Ludgate, the shopkeepers wanted her made an example of, and she was held. You know, they say that the child was sucking at her breast when she set out for Tyburn. Tyburn was where all the hangings took place at the time. But, you know, we've gone through, you know, just the British, never mind, you know, other people, but the British particularly, you know, our ancestors have endured so much, you know, to create the civilization we've got, and basically our politicians are simply giving it away to any, you know, any Tom, Dick and Harry that makes it to the country, you know, in the back of a lorry. It's disgraceful.
Yeah, you bring up instances like that. You know, it's not just the battles that we've fought and the blood that's, you know, on the battlefield. It's all the people that fought to give us these freedoms that we have today.
Freedom to think that they're now getting rid of.
Yes.
I've got a really good website for you. I think you'll love it.
Go on.
It's called allaboutscience.org.
Allaboutscience.org.
Yeah.
What does that entail?
This is something that it's really mind-boggling to me. I don't know what other people would think of it, but it's to me it's absolutely fantastic. Does infinity exist? Does it really exist? Have you ever heard of Olber's paradox?
I don't think I have.
No, I hadn't either until earlier today. Because the media is presenting all this evolution stuff, and I'm an evolutionary psychologist. You know, I can't knock the the evolutionary psychology because there's a theory it works. But you know, these are big questions, mind-boggling questions. Right, Olber's paradox. If the universe is infinite, the night sky should be bright.
Yes, yeah, I've heard that. The night sky should be lit up all the time because there'd just be stars everywhere.
Because if the universe is infinite, every time you in every line of sight, you should ultimately come across a star. Because if the universe is infinitely large, then there's an infinite number of stars. So every time in every direction you look, you should ultimately come across a star. And that star will be shining. And its brightness doesn't diminish over distance, only the time it takes to get here. So if the universe was infinitely large, then the night sky should be bright. And it's a phenomenal thing to think about. All right, you know, there might be planets in the way and things like that, but then the planets should reflect the light from the stars, just as our moon does, and it's in the media is I think that the 90% of Jewish behaviour is accountable by just pure paranoia, and they are paranoid that they're terrified of a Christian revival.
I think you're right. I think you're right.
And that's why they push evolution so much. And I was talking to a woman once, and I said, you know, actually, you know, there are serious problems with evolution theory. And she said, well, what do we believe then? You know, is there a God in the heavens, you know, that's looking after everything, that created everything? I said, well, it's as good an explanation as any.
Yeah, it makes more sense than the theory of evolution as well. You know, that's what gets me about it.
That's very debatable. I mean, we could argue about that for, you know, till
the chaos come on. Well, we better not get into a debate over evolution. But yeah, I'll check that out. I know that there's lots of problems with Einstein's theories as well, and quantum physics, and there's the electric universe theory, which explains the whole universe and cosmology in a far, far better way than quantum physics does, and it's testable. You know, it says that everything is electric, and we have an ether, and gravity is magnetism. And every prediction that they've made about things such as comets, like NASA told us a comet was a dirty snowball, and they said, well, no, it's not a dirty snowball. It's either positively or negatively charged thing going through space, and it's solid. And when NASA tried to land their probe on it, it bounced. And the Electric Universe Theory guys were right with their prediction of what would happen to this probe, and that comets weren't icy snowballs. And they can scale down their experiments because electricity can be scaled up. And what we see, these Birkeland currents and the shapes of the stars that we see, it's all electric currents. And you can scale these currents down and do these experiments on Earth and predict what's going to happen and do proper experiments. And you can't do any proper experiments for anything that Einstein came up with, the quantum physics and all of this, you know, the universe is 99% dark matter. They've had to invent that 99% matter that we can't actually detect to compensate for all their other theories that have been proved wrong when they do the tests. But they can't then say, oh, we were actually wrong about this. They say, oh, well, we'll have to invent this this new substance, dark matter. And it's basically just saying, just believe in this. We'll tell you to believe in this. Well, I would rather believe in what my ancestors told me.
I can't comment. It's not my field. I just don't know enough. I know that site, allaboutscience.org, is got lots and lots of scientific stuff from a Christian perspective, and it's certainly true that a lot of this astrophysics stuff, it does like really do verge on religiosity.
Scientism, isn't it? Scientism, isn't it? It's a new religion that's come up. Is scientism, Holocaustianity. We live in an age of all these man-made religions. Instead of now that we've sort of said, well, we'll just do away with God and we'll create our own religions. And they don't call them religions.
As much faith is required to believe some of the scientific theories of the universe as is required to believe in God.
Completely. Evolutionary psychology, I think, well, there's loads of evidence for that. And that isn't one kind growing into another. I'm absolutely fascinated by it, and you know, especially by Kevin MacDonald's work, who does it on Jews, and your work, where you've done it on women. I must remind people to read your book, Sex and Power, and we've got a link to it in the sidebar at Radio Aryan.
Yeah, Simon, I'm grateful for that.
You're welcome. People should read that. It's the best book ever written on male-female relations. Simon, thank
That's
you.
That's quite a compliment.
It's true. It's the truth. Thank you very much for coming on today, Simon. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Nat Danelaw. God bless and hail victory.